Welcome to Success Made to Last. I'm Tim Moore. This is the podcast that helps you live the best version of you, where we interview people who live lives of excellence, brought to you by Gracefully Yours. Today we have with us Kevin Wilhelm. Kevin and I have known each other, I think, about 12, maybe 13 years, and we published two books together back in another lifetime. Kevin was born in Granville, Ohio, which is rural Ohio, about 40 miles east of Columbus. He went to McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, Burger, and later got an MBA at the Daniels College of Business at the University of Denver. He's worked as a GM of the Minnesota Thunder pro soccer team and PR and communications director for the Seattle Sounders pro soccer team, and has been the CEO of his own firm, Seattle-based Sustainable Business Consulting, a company dedicated to helping companies and other organizations understand and implement the bottom line business benefits of sustainable practices. Kevin's a great guy, and he seems to remember every bleeping sporting event he's ever seen. And lately, he's written a fine book called How to Talk to the Other Side, Finding Common Ground in a Time of Coronavirus, Recession, and Climate Change. Welcome, Kevin. How are you today?
I'm great, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. Kevin, let's talk a little bit about your background before we talk about the book. Some of this talk about the background will set up a discussion about the book. You know, you've lived in rural America, urban America, the Midwest, the West, and now Seattle. A lot of those places, you know, folks in some parts of the country never been to. They fly over them, right?
Right.
And talk about your journey from Granville.
You know, it's a hilarious journey that I get asked a lot when people say, you know, hey, I want to, you know, get to your point in a career, or I want to do something in sustainable business. You know, tell me your path. I say, oh God, whatever you do, don't follow my path. But you know, I grew up in, you know, a small town in rural Ohio that was pretty mixed. You know, it was one of these things where you had a lot of really technical people because you had an academic institution there, Denison University. You had Dow and Owens Corning both had the research facilities there. So you had side of town that was incredibly educated and highly technical. And then you had a lot of farmers and rural, you know, individuals, and their lives couldn't be any different. And so growing up kind of in a small town where, you know, everyone just kind of like knew each other, liked each other, even though we were incredibly different, kind of, you know, set the foundation for a lot of kind of my life and this book, in that, you know, I grew up in a, you know, we all grew up in a time when, you know, people were more civil to each other, where politics was one little aspect of who your personality was. And as I moved throughout the country, you know, for college, for different, you know, my MBA, and I worked in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where, you know, the first question on people's minds was, what experience do you have in tier one, tier two auto supplier experience? And you're like, you know, this only exists in like a one county in the country kind of thing. And then being in the West, Mountain West, and out in Seattle. And I think one of the things was that really drove home to me was that I really felt like, for the most part, we're all very similar. We all have kind of the same goals and aspirations. People are great. They're nice anywhere in the country. What gets us kind of caught and trapped in these boxes of divisiveness is all the noise we hear in the media and social media and in our politics. When you strip that away, you can accomplish just about anything, but we've allowed ourselves to get to a point where we're allowing the noise to be the most important thing, as opposed to just being kind of a sideshow. And I really felt like I wanted to take the experience from not only my life, but my client work at Sustainable Business Consulting, because we've worked with 165 plus organizations around the country and even around the globe. And we're hitting people from every different perspective that you can imagine. And every single time, you know, you're able to find common ground, you're able to find, you know, a way to have conversations and get there. And then of course, at some point, someone makes a political comment and you can feel the room freeze. And so I just really felt like in our divisive time that we're in right now, that I wanted to put forward some solutions, put forward a kind of a positive path forward of how we can get back to not only getting things done, but, you know, just engaging with each other in a more civil manner.
Kevin, you know, I when I was a kid, there was no place it seemed to me to be in the city. You know, I lived in Boston for 6 years. It was a fabulous time, of course, to live in Boston. And, you know, you could live in Boston at that time for about $300 a month or something ridiculous like that. You know, around New York City for most of my life. And as I get older, I seem to want to get further away from cities and get closer to a rural feel. Talk about the pros and cons of the various places that you've lived. And is there sort of an ages and stages to this, you know, location-based view of things? Or is it just me?
I mean, I certainly think so, too. And, you know, I grew up in a small town where you could just walk everywhere and, you know, there was no threat of anything. And I always remember just people saying, you know, you hear parents saying, oh, it's a great place to raise kids. And as a kid, you're like, God, it's so boring. There's nothing to do. I want to, you know, be in a city. I want to, you know, when I went to college and, you know, was in the Twin Cities, and I was like, wow, people have been to clubs before and dancing and all, whoa, this is crazy. You know, city buses, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I think what you've really hit it, I think that, you know, there is kind of a, you know, if people grow up in cities and they have the ability to kind of move out, I mean, it's been a generational thing, you know, since the 50s where, you know, if you're affluent enough, you move out to the suburbs, you try and get away from the downtown, you try and get away from the hustle and bustle, the noise, the crime, you know, the, just, you know, whatever, the traffic. And, you know, it's interesting because I grew up completely small rural town and now I'm, you know, living right in the middle of a big city. And, but I think there's definitely a pull, you know, at different times of your life about what's exciting, where, you know, where jobs are, where, you know, where your interests are. And then things change. Certainly as you have families, as you have kids, as you, you know, look towards retirement, where you want to be spending your time. I think, you know, what you've done, Tim, in terms of modeling, moving from the cities to then moving outside of Austin, Texas, where you don't have to shovel sunshine, you know, I think is a great model. And I think that there's certainly, I think, right now, I'm sensing with all the interviews we did and the focus groups we ran in this book that that people are longing for a simpler time and they, you know, a simpler life. And I can see there being a lot of pull to that.
Yeah, here in Texas, obviously a lot of people are moving here, but and the cities are growing, obviously, and will continue to do so. But Texas Monthly had an issue a few months ago that, you know, all the little towns in this state are growing at leaps and bounds. The 5,000 person towns are growing to 10,000, they're growing to 15,000. Of course, that's an issue in and of itself. But I do think people do want to get away from, even here in Austin, you know, it's a 45-minute commute from here downtown. I live 22 miles from the center of town. 45 minutes sounds like a breeze in L.A. and New York, but still, you know, it's not optimal, is it? You know, Kevin, when you, up until your MBA studies, you worked in what must have been for you, knowing your obsession with sports, I mean, madness, really. But you worked in sports management. So what was the motivation to leave that part of the universe? One, two, get an MBA, and then three, go off and, you know, start a new business in sustainable practices, you know, I'm presumably bootstrapping it and all the joys of that.
You know, again, when people ask that, I'm like, it's really a simple story. It's almost like out of Goodwill Hunting. I was chasing a girl, not my wife, you know, and we were, so getting into soccer was hilarious because, you know, my whole life, you know, I grew up in a family of academics, five of the six of us, you know, became professors. So my whole life, I thought, you know, again, being from a small town, like, oh, I'll be a history teacher and maybe the soccer coach of the high school, wherever I end up. You know, that was about the extent of my worldview before I got to college. And then as I got into, you know, school and wanted to really like get out and take internships and jobs, you know, I, you know, ventured into politics, I ventured in financial planning, I ventured into, you know, business, you know, large chemical companies, you know, just anything where I could gain experience. And I really realized like, gosh, you know, business is this area where it's kind of the intellectual challenge. But I found that, you know, when I was working for nonprofits or when I was working in politics, everyone needed money and everyone was like trying to do their cause, but they needed money. And I thought, you know, if you could find a way where you could use money to do the right thing and have a business that did the right thing, then you kind of solve it all at once. And so that was kind of one of my big ahas. But that was kind of put on hold because, you know, at the time it was like graduating as a college senior, not knowing what the heck to do with my life. And, but I, you know, I played soccer. My wife, then girlfriend, was playing soccer, and there was a local pro team called the Minnesota Thunder, that had an internship. And so I went, and for $0 for like 4 months, I worked for free and then had this fortune where the director of operations got mono for a month. And so the GM at the time, you know, said, "Hey, you know, I can pay you $200 a month if you'll step into this director of operations role." And I was like, "Oh my God," you know, of course I didn't realize what absolute, I was being so absolutely taken advantage of. My God, you know, they were saving like $5,000 a month, you know, what this other guy's salary was. But I just got into it and worked my way up. And then about 2 years into it, my boss left for Major League Soccer and I was appointed the general manager and president and absolutely loved it and was like, oh my God, at one point I'm the youngest general manager in pro sports in the United States. But I also then opened this drawer when I got to go sit at his desk and there was, you know, $250,000 of unpaid bills. And I was like, whoa, you know, I thought I was like stepping in this position where, you know, everything's going to be golden. And all of a sudden I'm in this complete financial crisis where I'm wondering, my God, if we don't make playoffs, are we going to even be able to pay salaries? And so it was a quick like life lesson right there. Like, and I said to myself, I'm never going to be put in a position where I'm not prepared for that again. So right then I was like, I have to go get an MBA. I have to really understand the financials because even in this like utopia of working in pro sports, it still came down to dollars and cents and understanding how to, you know, move cash flow. So that's what led me out of pro sports for a few years. And then of course chasing the girl, my wife, all around the country. And we ended up, you know, landing in Seattle, we landed in Denver, we landed in Ann Arbor. And each time I kind of had that thing in the back of my head of, I want to do business. I want to show business that they can make more money by doing the right thing. And it goes back to a lot of the stuff we knew in the 70s, you know, just using less energy, using less water, using, you know, generating less waste. Because if you generate less waste and you stop your consumption on the front end, you're spending less money there, then you're spending less money on the back end when you throw stuff out. So all of it was just around like pure business stuff. But as I was looking at these business things, I was realizing there's an environmental benefit. There's some social benefit to all this as well. And that's really what led me to launch Sustainable Business Consulting. I had a huge war chest of $500 in the bank and a cell phone and a logo that I, you know, downloaded for free from Microsoft Windows and launched it. And then here we are, you know, I guess now 16 years later. And, you know, we've been an award-winning place to work for 3 out of the last 5 years. You know, worked with some of the biggest clients in the world, and we're having that impact. And even now, during this financial crisis and this pandemic, I'm able to fall back on those very basic business skills of, you know, going to companies and saying, I know you want to put your climate programs and environmental programs on hold, but hold on a minute. Let's first do a cost-saving facilitation and show you all the ways we can save money during this pandemic by being proactive. And businesses are still engaging with that.
Yeah, that's really amazing. Yeah, I've often said it's easy to do good. It's easy to make money at some level. But it's really hard to do good and make money. And by the way, if you do good and make money, it is, well, sustainable, right?
Right, yeah.
You did and continue to do very important work in your work, Kevin, but you don't lead with the political arguments of the climate change narrative, which I presume would be polarizing.
Yep.
Which is bound to excite some people that you talk to and bound to anger or annoy others. And gosh, you don't even know who they are before you excite or annoy them. You lead with the bottom line benefits of sustainability. Who could object to that? Saving money, making money. Talk about not only that decision, and maybe you already have, but how does that play out in practice for most businesses? I mean, I think a lot of people, as you say in the book, and we've said, you know, we've talked to each other, most people look at, you know, green stuff, if you will, as an extra cost. And yet, I think you're the only guy I've ever read or known, and I read a lot, as you well know, who's actually said, no, it's not an extra cost. It's a savings. Talk about that a little bit. Proselytize that idea a little bit, because I think that's a game changer. It takes out the politics, doesn't it? Who doesn't want to save money? Oh, and by the way, you know, you're not polluting stuff.
Yeah, and that's really the message. And I think that, you know, I point out in the book that, you know, people forget that in 1988, President George H.W., you know, Bush ran as our environmental president.
Right.
And what's happened is, as it's gotten politicized and, you know, as somebody's, you know, political affiliation has, you know, gone, we've let the kind of, again, the media and the social media and the noise kind of just drop us into two tribes. The reality is that, and we did a ton of research on this and found that when you poll people ages 18 to 38, actually, they all agree that they should take action on climate change. And actually, conservatives see climate change as a bigger issue and more important and bigger existential threat than people that are younger and more liberal. And so it's more of a generational divide than it is kind of a political or mindset divide. But I've found that throughout my career, whenever my firm, you know, goes somewhere, I'm asked to speak, you know, just coming in with the name Sustainable Business Consulting, people are assume that I'm some lefty, atheist, vegan, Prius driving Democrat. And
oh, you're not.
Right. I'm certainly not a vegan. I'm not atheist. And I drive a Leaf, because who would drive a gas guzzling, planet killing machine like a Prius? But they, you know, what I found is that if you strip away the politics and you just get to the kind of the business side of saving or making money, if it's a business, then no one's gonna disregard that. If you're talking to a nonprofit and you show them how, by, you know, saving this money or using sustainable business practices, can bring in additional grants that fund the organization that allow them to do their mission, therefore it. If you talk with government agencies who certainly now are incredibly strapped, and you'd say, here's some operations that allow you to do some of the other things that your mayor or your city council wanted to do for political points, they're interested in it. And so it's, you know, by just taking and reframing the argument, and we do this throughout the book, whether it's business environment, rural, urban, whether it's fossil fuels versus renewables, by focusing kind of on that, that dollars and cents, it's a nonpartisan, non-ideological issue.
Yeah, it does become that. You find common ground and you find it through business. Why did you decide to write this book, Kevin? I mean, it's one thing to identify all the things that you've just described. It's one thing to sort of sit in our houses and pine the fact that, you know, that we seem to be in these separable tribes. Although I think, as you mentioned, it's probably on the ground, we're less tribal than we are in the media. A lot of reasons for that, but that's another issue for another day, perhaps. But why did you decide to, you know, not just sit in your house and feel bad about it, but write a book?
Well, you know, I think it was somewhat of a calling, somewhat of being pissed off that, you know, I needed to do something, that, you know, the what I'm doing with my work is amazing. I'm teaching at, you know, various universities, but it just wasn't enough. I wasn't getting it out there. And I felt like, you know, I would go and give a 2-hour guest lecture at a university or teach a 10-week class, and people weren't getting the skills that they needed and the tools and techniques to actually move the ball forward. Or even when I was working with organizations that were trying to lobby Congress or even, you know, our state legislature here in Washington, And, you know, in the back of my head, I was like, well, this is a way to kind of cut through. At first, it was, how do we cut through the political polarization? And, but, you know, and I did a bunch of writing, a bunch of research, a bunch of interviews in the fall. But really, when the pandemic broke out, it was like, we need to have a solution, because back in February, I completely foresaw what we're seeing now, that things like masks were going to become politicized, you know, public health would be politicized, everything's just getting politicized. And we can't afford to do that as a society. You know, people are dying, businesses are going under, the economy's, you know, tanking, society's being ripped apart because we're allowing it. And I just felt like there needed to be a positive path forward. And if we could show people non-ideological ways, that win-win strategies and ways that they could talk to people that they disagreed with, that if we could start there and show them, you know, these bridge building techniques, that then we could go start tackling some of these bigger issues that we're seeing. I've been finding that from everybody I've been talking to, that it's a valuable technique there. And it's an incredibly valuable technique for people's families, because everyone's got the crazy uncle or aunt or the middle child that, you know, completely disagrees with them and they don't know how to talk to them anymore. And I'm getting these comments from my parents' friends that are like, oh my gosh, this is so helpful. Now I can talk to this part of my family again, that part of my family again. And I'm like, right, how did we ever get to this place? And it's almost like we've forgotten, you know, all the muscle memory of how we used to do things. And we need to just be reminded that we can get back and we can take practical solutions that can save people's lives and save the economy at the same time. It doesn't have to be an either or.
Yes, that's well put, Kevin. That's probably a good spot for me to just stop and pause for a moment and go to a brief ad from our sponsor, Gracefully Yours. Michael, drop in the Gracefully Yours spot here, please. Kevin, you suggest 10 ways in the book to help make a fruitful conversation with a person from the other side, as it were. A couple of them seem to me to be really, really important. I start with the first rule, and connect on a personal level. Talk about this and why it's so important.
I think for so many people, if you think about your day-to-day interaction, when you are at the grocery store, when you're at a kid's ball game, or you're at a friend's house, I mean, this is all pre-pandemic, when you can actually still go and actually talk to people. You know, when you're at a bar, when you're starting conversation with someone, you don't immediately launch into your religion or your opinions on immigrants or guns or, you know, what you think about, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, or Joe Biden or Donald Trump. You start with, you know, things you can find in common with people. You know, what's the weather like? What food do you like? You know, what sports are on TV that, you know, what team do you follow? Where are you from? You know, and or where are you traveling to? And you realize that making that human connection and finding that you'll find that the person you're talking to that may be politically polar opposite to you, about 80 to 90% of the values they have in their life and things that they want to accomplish are the exact same as yours. And so I start with, let's start with where we have the common ground. And if you can do that and you start listening to the other person before you start talking, it's a way of, you know, having a conversation, establishing a baseline of trust or a commonality that makes it a lot harder to demonize someone, you know, and really angrily disagree with them when you've already found, you know, a reason to happily connect with them.
I've often thought that, and I've said this a lot of times, I might have even said it to you, because we think a lot alike and have some of the same skill sets, and I think everybody should have a sales job sometime in their life, preferably like at the age of like 23. Because, you know, I remember to this day, about 100 years ago, you know, being trained in my first sales job. And the first thing they told us that we were supposed to do, because it would make for better conversations, was to ask whoever it was you were talking to something about themselves. And, you know, to this day, unconsciously now, in any conversation I enter into with a new person, it's one of the reasons I use the backgrounds, for instance, in Zoom, is to start a conversation that connects. Because once you're connected, you know, then it's hard to rend. Once you're connected, it's harder to just to dismiss somebody the way that we can in social media, where everything is anonymous. Right. And I think that's a really, really important. And I think you get that because, you know, you're essentially a sales guy, you know. And, well, everybody's essentially a sales guy. They just don't know it. You know, they either are or they're not. And, you know, if they're not, there's something that's going to hold them back, it seems to me. Because that's a really important, that connect with people. The second one I think is really, really important is one that the Covey children, and I happen to know two of them, but the Covey children, you know, talk about their dad and Stephen Covey, and they talk about the most important lesson that their father taught them. And that important lesson was listen before being heard. And that's one of the seven habits of Stephen Covey. The fact that you must try to understand first before trying to be understood. Again, why is that important, Kevin?
Well, I should say that Covey says seek to understand before being understood. I use listen to be
right,
heard.
Right. Excuse me.
No worries. It's what my – so I can give that one to Sarah Jean Wilhelm, my mom, who taught me that when I was like –
Oh, really? No kidding.
77 or something. But –
Wow.
You know, what I found is that behind everyone, when you start having these bigger discussions, there is – fear, anxiety, and there's hope behind whatever, you know, there is. So if you run into someone who is, you know, anti-immigrant or pro-immigrant, or you run into someone who wants, you know, renewable energy, or somebody who wants, you know, coal to continue, and they feel that their livelihood in the community is threatened. What I've found is by listening first and seeking to kind of understand where they're coming from, because when, you know, someone will say, you know, I don't believe in the science on climate change. Once you start peeling the onion back and you listen and you inquire and you find out what is truly at their anxiety, and that it's, you know, that they don't want to have to give up their car, or they're worried about losing their job, or they're worried about the impacts on their community, then you can kind of understand what is truly at the core of their issue and their anxiety, or even in their hope and their aspiration. And then you can engage. But so often people start at that really high level. I was just doing a podcast the other day, and someone was saying, well, you know, if someone doesn't believe it on climate change, I feel like it's my duty to educate them on the science and the facts. And I say, well, that's never going to work, because people a lot of times make decisions based on emotion and not on reason. And so you have to first get past the emotion. It's kind of like, I tell people, it's like dealing with a toddler that's having a temper tantrum. You can't reason with them while they're smashing stuff. You gotta wait for them to calm down, and then you can have a conversation with them. And so when you really want to listen to what is at the core of someone's resistance. And so we have an example in the book where we talk about the urban rural divide, and, you know, you've got these, you know, ranchers and farmers in Montana who, you know, for years have been saying, you know, look, we can't reintroduce wolves. We can't reintroduce endangered species because they're going to kill our livestock. And, you know, you hear that and you're like, well, gosh, you know, don't you see there's this bigger thing at play, and environmentalists would come to them and talk to them about economic or, you know, environmental diversity and the importance of this. Really, when you peel back the onion, the ranchers were like, it's just not fair. You know, like, my cow gets killed. I developed this long form. It's really difficult. I send it in. I'm reimbursed half the time. You know, it's a pain. It's bureaucratic. You know, I understand that we need to reintroduce these animals, but, you know, like, it's the fairness isn't there. It's all
I'm carrying the burden. Yeah, I'm carrying the burden. Right.
And so once you understand, oh, they just don't want to bear all the burden. They want fairness. You know, the American Prayer Reserve, we highlight this in the book, came up with a solution where, you know, instead of, you know, having to show harm, they put up cameras so every time one of these endangered species walked across their property, a camera would go off and they would automatically receive a check. And so all of a sudden, these ranchers who've been so opposed to it and seeing these animals as nuisances, all of a sudden is like a financial windfall. And we're like, yeah, okay. And I don't have to like, if a calf dies, I don't have to take a photo of it and show proof and all this. I can actually just, you know, it just dies, but I'm getting more money. I'm doing fine. And oh, by the way, like the harm isn't that great. And now I feel like you're sharing the burden. I'm sharing the burden. And it just changed the entire conversation. And it's a positive path forward that accomplishes the environmentalist goals. And the rancher who is out there, you know, would say, you know, there's a whole reason I live out here on this ranch. I already believe in the environment. I live in the environment. I don't want some, you know, bureaucrat coming from a city, you know, telling me what to do. I know how to manage my land. Just let me do it. And once you start realizing that that's the conversation that people want to have, that's where the anxiety and the anger, but also the hope is, then you have a solution.
Yeah, it's meeting people where they are. And it's also having respect for their expertise. I mean, it's not like Bloomberg sitting and saying he could teach someone how to farm. Sure, Michael. And frankly, for that farmer, that those words or words like it reverberate in their brain as they're thinking about the issue, doesn't it? So, well, those people they don't believe. They think I'm an idiot. They don't know that. They don't know how hard it is to do this. They don't know the science that I've had to learn, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
When you meet someone go ahead.
I was going to say, and people forget, it's certainly that people have never farmed. This is where it goes back to, you know, my rural upbringing. They say, farmers are the original environmentalists. Farmers are the original scientists. I mean, farmers are experimenting with things all the time and keeping plots of land, that they're experimenting new ways of irrigation and new techniques for growing and weeding and you know, attacking pests, you know, whether it's using a herbicide or pesticide or to some natural thing. They're experimenting all the time. And, you know, we highlight in the book that, you know, there's this mindset of what a farmer does, but it's not what it truly is nowadays. I mean, one of our clients at Sustainable Business Consulting, people walk around with iPhones and iPads through the hop fields to know exactly when to give the plant the water. And they do that because this is a way that they're using technology to use less water, to get the water to the plant when it needs it, to get the best opportunity to survive. It saves them money. They have a better harvest. And even in animal husbandry, you know, we used to think, oh, you know, you get your big steer and you take him down to the stockyards and you would, you know, find one and mate him up. No, nowadays they're going on the internet and they're ordering, you know, sperm and eggs online from Europe and having to be sent in, you know, freeze-dried packages to their house and having to artificially inseminate. I mean, that's how it's getting done. These are smart, sophisticated people that know what they're doing. And we tried to really go to lengths to show that in our book, that that's what's really happening and people need to respect that and honor that.
Yeah. And some of that, you know, is because we don't live in small towns anymore, Kevin, isn't it? You know, because when you lived in a small town, you know, if you insulted somebody, there were consequences potentially. Maybe not physical. The consequences might be that the person insulted would tell your parents, and then there were consequences.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
You know. It's the old look in the mirror phenomenon. You had to. Every day you were looking in the mirror. It's just looking at somebody else. Talk about a couple. There's some great case studies in your book about how a few instances where what could have been large, intractable problems become solved sustainably. It seems to be not only sustainably, but better. Better from a cost perspective, a sustainability perspective, and perhaps from a perspective of it will work better. And the two that I liked a lot, they happen to be on a sequential in the book, but I thought they were really interesting, is the mangrove story in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. The fact that that because there weren't mangroves there before, the flood and after Katrina was worse, and then what they did to fix that, and then the natural stormwater treatment in Seattle. I mean, those are really they're impressive examples of two sides coming together and coming up with a novel solution that I bet you both sides were surprised they came up with.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that the story of New Orleans, I mean, you know, the fact that the Army Corps of Engineers went in and only built, after Katrina, only built levees to another Category 3 hurricane, when you're like, wait, we just had a Category 5. Why wouldn't you build it to that level? Was ridiculous. But as you looked at what, you know, where the costs are, where the benefits, I mean, one of the things around New Orleans is, as they've had to open up these shipping channels, they've just, you know, and take bigger and bigger ships. They've gone through and swept and took out the mangrove swamps and took out the tidal basins that provided the natural barriers for storm surge. And when they looked at, should we, you know, further reinforce with hard concrete around the entire region, you know, to get to a Category 5, or should we just plant some mangrove swamps that will stop the surge? They found that it was way more cost effective. Plus, it would help clean up the Gulf. It would bring back natural habitat for the pelicans and the fish. It would help clean up all the herbicides that are coming down from the Mississippi River. You know, it had all these natural benefits. And so that was one. And then the example in Seattle and Duwamish, you know, these, for those of you who haven't read the book, there's an example where the old Boeing manufacturing plant, where plant two, where B-17s were made, and the Duwamish area is a heavily industrialized river through Seattle. Every time it rained, you know, all these particulate matter would just drain right into the Duwamish, and the actual sediment under the water was a Superfund site. So the water was okay, but the dirt under it was a Superfund site. And of course, the EPA came out and had a 20-year plan. It was going to cost billions of dollars. So how we're going to do this? And you just kind of thought, what's a more cost? And so you had environmentalists saying, yes, we need to clean this up. And you also had, you know, people saying, we don't have, you know, billions of dollars to do this. What's a more effective way of doing it? And by putting in natural bioswales between, you know, with these areas that would cover the runoff, it was a way of cleaning up the water before it goes back into the Duwamish, so you're not further polluting. But also the plants served as natural filters, and they had a way of actually cleaning the water that had been in there in the sediment, and it brought back fish and it brought back birds, and it opened up a whole nother way of doing things at about half the cost. And so I think these two are just examples of when you kind of think outside of the box and you're not going, you know, and you're focused on what is the goal as opposed to how do we get there. And I think that was one of the other big things that we hit on with the book, is that it's kind of like that Harry Truman adage that, you know, you'd be amazed at what you can get done as long as you don't care who gets credit. And I think that's the thing. It's like, if we're all saying we want to solve this problem, you know, we don't care how it's done, but let's just solve it. And, you know, then a lot of solutions come up. And I think we're seeing that right now with both the pandemic and the economic recovery that we're trying to do, is that people are already jumped into their camps one side or another. And if we can just agree that, hey, I don't want you to die, and I'm sure you probably, or you may or may not, but you don't want your parents to die. So let's start there. And then I want to keep my job and you want to keep your job. Okay, let's start there. And then how can we get there? And then all the ideas and solutions can come there. But we've already, like, even now, we're only two and a half months into this thing, and people have already dived, you know, into their camps. And so those two examples were illustrative ones to show that these big intractable problems, that just by thinking creatively and by using sustainability as a way to kind of cut through the noise, you can find that common ground solution.
Kevin, I mentioned my two favorite rules of your 10, but do you have another favorite rule if you had only three to choose, do you have another favorite rule that you want to, I don't want to give them all away because then people won't read the book, you know, but what's another one that jumps out at you and that you think is just so essential that people should hear about?
Well, I think that going with the listen before being heard, I think, you know, just empathizing and is a way of like really lowering the temperature of a conversation. I think, you know, it really gets to that, you know, if you, it, you know, so often, you know, people just want to be heard. They just want to understand what's going on. And you take an example about what's going on in Minneapolis right now or throughout the country, that, you know, the Black community is saying, you know, we just want to be treated a certain way. We just want to be heard. We want to be listened to. We want to be respected. And by showing empathy as opposed to immediately dismissing their idea and going to a solution, you can get somewhere. And I think that so often what's missed, and I talk about some points 4 and 5, that it's sometimes not what you say, but how you say it. And, you know, and I think that if in any type of disagreement, you know, whether it's an environmental one, a political one, a public health one, if you're not using the words you towards someone else, you know, I mean, there's a classic diplomacy, and we talked about this, that, you know, the State Department teaches diplomats, you know, saying your solution, as opposed to the solution that's being put forward is something that our party, you know, has issues with, is a totally different way that people can hear it. And if it's said in a respectful tone, as opposed to like the anger, because people will, when someone's angry and they're saying something, more often than not, everyone's responding to that anger, and they're either getting frustrated themselves, or they're like, how can I stop this person from screaming at me? And they're not even paying attention to what they're saying. They just want to stop being screamed at. And so I think that for both sides, that if they can really incorporate some of these tools and techniques into kind of having those conversations, it's a way more effective way of, finding that common ground and a path forward.
You know, one of the things that is almost unsaid in the book, it's certainly not one of the 10 rules, but one of the things that sits sort of as a meta rule is, and you said it, maybe the first sentence that you use, first paragraph anyway, politics is not everything.
Yeah.
It's only a small subset of what, it should only be a small subset of what who we are. In fact, I think that if politics is everything, then there's very little to you.
Right.
In all likelihood. Maybe it's for some people a new religion, but it strikes me that, you know, when you take that, people are really interesting one at a time. A person I know was once described as being able to go into a building back in the days when corporations were entirely in buildings, and have a conversation from the janitor all the way up to the CEO.
Right.
And, you know, all those people have a really cool story. And I don't know, those cool stories are somehow more interesting to me than whether or not they voted for so-and-so or so-and-so, even
right.
though the outcome of those votes is important, but not in your day-to-day life with other human beings.
Yeah. I mean, I think certainly there's been a change, in the last, 8 to 12 years, obviously, about, you know, because some of these things that are happening in our politics actually can really impact people. But I think, to your point, you know, I mean, I started that right off the bat with that, you know, growing up in a town where you knew everybody, certainly we had, you know, people that were Republicans and Democrats. And, you know, this was during the Reagan years, and Democrats didn't like Reagan, and certainly people didn't like Carter. But it was just a small portion of who you were. You were Americans. You came from the same town. What religion did you, you know, what school did you go to? Those were where your allegiances were and are. When you think about it, it's what do people care about when they're in this quarantine? You know, they're longing to be with their friends, but they're also, you know, what school did you go to? You know, where are you alumnus? What activities did you do? Were you part of a fraternity or sorority? You know, and I find that, you know, the politics is such a small part of it. I mean, I'll just admit that I gave a talk a few months ago, and Tim, I think you would love this. I had both a Biden hat and a Hillary hat, and I went and gave the talk. And excuse me, not a Biden, I had a Trump hat and a Hillary hat.
I knew which one. Go ahead.
I had one there, so excuse me on that. And I was giving this talk to a bunch of business conservatives, and I put on the Trump hat just to start. And, you know, you can kind of see people go, you know, their eyes kind of open up, you know, they weren't expecting that.
And then, you know, just casually without in the conversation, I didn't even change my tone or anything. I just kept going. I swapped hats. And I kept just talking through my presentation, saying the same stuff. And you could literally see people visibly start to, you know, like now they didn't want to listen to what I had to say. You know, they didn't want to, you know, I went for just a couple minutes, and then I put the Trump hat back on. And they kind of relaxed. And then they started, you know, you could tell they started paying attention. They started asking questions again. And in the middle of one guy's question, I switched hats again. And he stopped mid-question and was like, I can't even finish this question while you wearing that hat. And I said, this just a hat. And I turned around and pretended like I didn't even know what the hats were. I was like, oh, I didn't even realize I had this hat on. I'm sorry. And I put the other hat back on and he finished his question. And I took it back off again. And I was like, do you realize what we're doing here, people? Like, I've just laid out ways for your business to save money, reduce risk, attract talent, increase your brand value, you know, all of these things that you all say that you need. It's that will improve your ROI as your business. You're getting hung up on a freaking hat. What if this had said Yankees or Red Sox or, you know, that's all.
Well, now that's doing. Important stuff.
I
now,
know,
Kevin.
Exactly. But if it had said Tampa Bay Devil, you know, Tampa Bay Devil Rays and Arizona Diamondbacks, no one would have cared. But I just said, look at what we've allowed ourselves to do just because of this. And we have to get out of that because, you know, when you go to a sporting event, and I talk about this book about finding common ground, that whether you're in the 300 deck or the 100 deck or you're at, you know, Memorial Stadium in Texas, you know, you're rooting on the horns, you are there, you know, you've got this common ethic and this common culture and this what you want out of it is a victory for your team. And you're not so like, does it need to be a defensive struggle or can it be a blowout, you know, passing game or all in the run game? You don't care how we get there. You just want your team to win. And I think that's what we're talking about with the book is that if we can just start with that shared aspiration that we all want to be happy. We want to be healthy. We want to breathe clean air. We don't want to get sick. We want to have a good job. We want to have a stable income. We start there. Then it doesn't really matter how we get there as long as what you take care of yourself, I take care of myself. And I think that's what gets, you know, so caught up in the politics.
Kevin, as we wind down turn the corner around third for home, as they say in baseball parlance, tell people out there how they can find out more about, one, your company, should they need your services, and two, how they can buy your book.
Sure. You know, my company is Sustainable Business Consulting. You can Google it or you can find it on the web at sustainablebizconsulting.com. Has a list of services and a ton of case studies on there for individuals who are, you know, maybe skeptical or they need to make the case to people within their organization as to can I, you know, make a business case for sustainability for the work that I'm trying to do. We have a ton of case studies there. As far as buying the book, you can buy it on Amazon. You know, it's called How to Talk to the Other Side, or you can type in my name, Kevin Wilhelm, or my co-author, Natalie Hoffman, into the book section, and it'll pop up. But and you can also find it on our website, but that's the fastest way to find it is through Amazon.
Well, Kevin, I'm hoping that we're going to have a baseball season and I can watch my Yankees on the YES Channel here in Austin. I'm hoping we're going to have a football season and go to DKR Memorial Stadium and watch the Texas Longhorns. And you can watch your Ohio State Buckeyes from a distance. We'll see how that all plays out. But I had a lot of fun doing this, Kevin. I always enjoy talking to you for all these years, and I appreciate your time here. And let me just sign off by asking everybody out there or telling everybody out there, I hope that you enjoyed this podcast. And remember to go to successmadetolast.com to register for our newsletter, filled with what I think at least is fun information about our future guests and great stuff in general. And go to your podcast distributor, iTunes, Spreaker, et cetera, and rate our show, please. Till next time, go out there and live the best version of you. Cheers.
So thanks to our sponsor, Edward Jones. They are our trusted financial advisor. And Edward Jones has been instrumental in helping us pivot our lives built around health, happiness, travel, and adding value to other people's lives. You can contact our advisor, Serban Marasini, by emailing him at serban.marasini@edwardjones.com. And thanks again to their sponsorship of this program. And thanks to our sponsor, Gracefully Yours Greeting Cards, and their hilarious Church Kitchen Lady cards. Church Kitchen Ladies are a bunch of maybe 20 million volunteers across the United States that work in 300,000 churches, and they say stuff like, mind your own biscuits and life will be gravy. They also say, crunch tacos, not abs. And psst, you're crazy is showing, you might want to tuck that back in. And one of our favorites is, life is short, lick the bowl. If you want to find out more about the wonderful Church Kitchen Ladies and join their roundtable, go to gracefully-yours.com today and find out about Church Kitchen Ladies and purchase all the rest of the fine Gracefully Yours greeting cards.